Organic practices in gardening and farming are getting to be more common every year in Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today is Horticulture Day. Iowa State University Extension Organic Specialist Kathleen Dellett will be here. She'll give us a preview of the 13th Annual Iowa Organic Conference. We'll also talk about organic certification, and of course, she'll answer any questions you may have about organic gardening. Iowa State University Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron will also be here to answer the rest of your lawn, garden, and landscaping questions. Email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and we're going to talk organic. Later in the hour, Iowa State University Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron will be here, but my first guest is Iowa State University or Extension Organic Specialist Kathleen Dellett. I'm tripping over my tongue today. Hello, Kathleen.
Hi, Charity. How's it going?
Good. Thank you so much for being here today. It's fun to have you in the studio today. And I know you're in town because you're working on planning the upcoming Iowa Organic Conference. This is the 13th annual Iowa Organic Conference coming up on November 17th and 18th in Iowa City. What's the focus of this year's conference?
Well, every year we try to do a little combination of practical, farmer-based information, latest updates in organic research, and what the industry is looking for. And then we'll also bring in a couple fun speakers, too, like Backyard Abundance right here in Iowa City, and Scott Koepke from New Pioneer Co-op talking about his Soil Mates program. So a mixture of everything.
And this is a cooperative effort from Iowa State University Extension, also the Leopold Center at Iowa State. And what other groups are involved in putting this on?
Well, we've been really fortunate to partner with the University of Iowa for the last 2 years, and particularly the Office of Sustainability. So Liz Christensen and George McCrory have been instrumental in getting us support, and also working with the Memorial Union. The folks there have been extremely welcoming. So that's where it will be, in the Memorial Union. New Pioneer Co-op is also a big sponsor here in town. And there's a lot of small nonprofits that will be there, too, from the Iowa City area that we consider partners, too.
Who comes to the conference?
Well, last year we had 375 people. We're hoping for 400 this year. And it was a mixture, I would say, 70% farmers. And then of the 30% remaining, mixture of consumers, agency people, and nonprofits.
Now, organic is something that, of course, we have seen grow in the marketplace over the last couple of decades, and it seems to continue to grow every year. Is that my perception, or what are the actual numbers? How much bigger is organic getting in Iowa?
Right. Your perception is correct. It has been growing. It's now a $63 billion industry in the world, and the U.S. has the largest market at $31 billion. So we're half that market. The last survey in Iowa was done in 2011, so I think there's higher numbers than what USDA NASS picked up then. And again, you have to remember, this is only the farms that reported, so I think it's under reporting that there were 467 organic farms in Iowa. The sales they tallied were $60.7 million in sales, and that made us the fifth largest number of organic producers in the country.
When I shop at the farmers market, of course, you see some people who sell who say that they have organic products. You see more and more stands, though, that say things like no spray, no pesticides. Why is it that we see people who are saying that they're using organic methods but not certified organic?
Right. And just want to say up front that the conference is open to everybody, not just organic or certified organic. But we also welcome conventional farmers who want to learn about organic. And, it's a choice if people want to get certified or not. We recommend it because you'll be able to sell to a lot more markets. For example, Whole Foods will not take your food if you just say it's organic. You have to show the certificate. Hy-Vee, same thing. For grain buyers, it's a must because they take it to bigger markets like Schooler Grain in Omaha, and you must have your certificate. So I think the further away from the customer you are, the more important the certificate is. So selling locally at a farmer's market where you know your clients, customers, and if they want, they can come out and visit your farm and see your methods and that you're not using pesticides, et cetera, then a lot of people don't feel the need for certification. That's fine.
And certification can be expensive, right?
Right. Although, okay, so we get about, I would say total, about 40 acres certified, and it costs us about $400. So if we end up selling soybeans for $25 a bushel instead of $13, you'll be able to reap that benefit immediately as soon as you sell it as certified organic.
Well, and let's talk about the price differential, because I guess, you know, a lot of us don't think about organic soybeans and organic corn. We see a lot of corn and soybeans around the state. That's not what we see at the farmers markets for sale. That's not what we're buying in the produce section of Whole Foods or the local co-op or your local grocery store. But what kind of market is there for organic corn?
It's a huge market. I just came from the Organic Trade Association meetings out in Baltimore, and they were begging that we can get more producers on the ground. They're having to buy from overseas to meet the demand for organic corn and soybean products. So right now, demand totally outstrips supply. We need a lot more growers, and that's part of our push, too, at this conference, is to try to get more conventional growers to think about growing organic corn and soybeans. And as I was saying, you know, you can get probably twice as much for the soybeans and corn selling for $10 to $13 a bushel for organic right now.
So there's quite the premium on it.
Big premium.
What's new in the world of organic these days?
Well, it's interesting because what people are considering new is actually something that's been around for a while. Just for example, cover crops. It's interesting to see how much emphasis has been placed on cover crops this year, which is great. But this has been a standard practice for a long time in organic farms, and it's actually required by law to be certified organic that you have to have soil building crops out there like cover crops. We've always seen the benefits of cover crops that increase diversity on the farm, feed the soil, and help retain nutrients on the farm. So it's great to see that that's being emphasized by the NRCS and other programs. We're also seeing increased interest in precision weeding used on organic farms to deal with herbicide-resistant weeds that are happening on conventional farms.
Okay, and define precision weeding for me.
Cultivating.
Okay. So basically, I mean, more traditional methods before we were spraying so much.
Exactly. Ironically, herbicide. Though, we just got a grant from USDA to look at robotic weeding.
I think that sounds – I would like that in my home garden.
Exactly.
Sounds very exciting.
Yeah. So this ag engineer at Iowa State, Lei Tang, just got this big grant to look at it, and we're going to be growing vegetables for him so he can use his robotic weeder on them. So excited about that. Also, you've seen in the news about researchers promoting crop rotations, just that anything other than corn and soybeans will – help the soil and help pest management and hopefully get you higher yields. So having that third crop in the rotation, which has always been part of organic practices, at the minimum they have three crops, mostly have four in the rotation. It's good to see that that's being recognized as a very positive thing.
So are you finding more collaboration and more crossover between someone like yourself that specializes in organic agriculture and people who have focused more on conventional over the years?
Yeah, I think it is happening that there are. We just had a meeting this week with a traditional corn breeder, and he's interested in looking at more varieties that could fit under organic conditions, such as cultivars that have more horizontal leaf spread, so it would reduce the sunlight underneath to the weeds, and you'd be getting better weed control as opposed to using herbicides. So things like that are happening. It's exciting. And then last but not least, GMO labeling. There's always been an interest from the organic community in that because it definitely helps improve sales to have that in the forefront. And it's a consumer-led initiative. If it doesn't pass through regulations, manufacturers are going to insist on it. There's a new project that's really taken off called Non-GMO Verified. And you can see that label now in the market more and more. So all these things help increase organic sales and push people to consider more and more organic production.
Now, I know that we had our ups and downs with the farming this year, with so much moisture this spring, and then it was so dry late in the year. One of the things we've been talking about a lot on this show over the past several weeks, in the last couple of months, in fact, is the huge fruit crops that people have been seeing, and also the fact that a lot of people who don't spray saw very few pests this year in their fruit crops. Is that something that organic farmers have been celebrating this year, a low number of pests?
Exactly. Yeah, we all are. We'll be having plenty of apples at the organic conference this year. It's a bumper crop for organic and conventional. And the main thing is, without that moisture, which was devastating to the corn and soybean crops, was actually beneficial for the fruit and vegetable crops. Now, vegetables took a lot more irrigation or moisture, so you needed to have irrigation to get a good crop of your organic vegetables this year. But the fruit crops, with their deep roots, they were able to survive the drought, and the crop was phenomenal.
Well, and of course, after last year, when nobody had a crop at all, every tree was so ready to really put on a lot of blossoms and make something happen.
And then came the frost.
Right.
Right. Yeah. And people even got peaches this year. So it was a phenomenal fruit year.
Well, about a year ago, I was talking to the proprietor of Grinnell Heritage Farm, and he was talking about the fact that on his farm, which of course is an organic farm, and they have a lot of different horticultural crops, he was saying that just the variety of things that he grows helped him weather the drought. Now, a lot of organic farms, and of course you can have an organic corn and soybean farm, but a lot of organic farms are more diversified. Is that something that you have seen benefiting those farmers through our crazy weather season?
Right. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because I forgot about our keynote speaker, who is a farmer named Bob Quinn, not the radio guy Bob Quinn, but a farmer from Montana, and he farms 4,000 acres of organic production out in Montana. And his whole thing is be diverse, because he has, I don't know how many crops total, but he grows fruits, vegetables, grains, alfalfa, and he believes that spreading the risk is absolutely the way to manage it during climate change.
Other than fruit this year, are there other bumper crops that you've been hearing about?
We just finished cutting the thousands of pounds of tomatoes that will go into the organic conference meal. Tomatoes were phenomenal this year, a little too much. And the sweet corn was okay, too, although it was irrigated. So I think there were problems in that we had to plant late. Some fields we had to replant. The beginning of the summer, I thought we wouldn't get a single crop, but fortunately, the drought actually did help in certain cases with fruits and vegetables.
You never know, do you? No. Every year is different. I'm talking with Kathleen Dellett. She is Iowa State University Extension Organic Specialist. We were talking about the upcoming 13th Annual Iowa Organic Conference, which is on November 17th and 18th in Iowa City this year. And you can find a link to find out more about the conference on our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio. ISU Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron will join us in a moment, and we'd love to hear your questions. 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me, Iowa State University Extension Organic Specialist Kathleen Dellett and ISU Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining the show today. And of course, you can join the show with your questions as well. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can tweet us at IPR Talk, or you can post on our Facebook page. Kathleen will field your organic questions today, and Richard will take care of the rest of the landscape, garden, yard questions that you may have. Although, A lot of plants have given it up for the growing season in this past week, haven't they, Richard?
Basically, quite a few, right? Especially last night, a nice calm night, clear night. It got quite cold, so.
Yeah, I saw 24 degrees at one point last night, so. And it sure felt cold.
The time has come.
All right. Let's get to the phones. Patty's on the line first in Des Moines. Hi, Patty.
Hi. I have a garden in a community. It's an organic community garden. And the guy next to me is an award-winning state fair guy, and he tills manure into his garden every year. What do you think about that?
Kathleen?
Manure is good. We all use manure in organic gardening and farming. However, In certified organic rules, you have to put your manure on 4 months ahead of horticultural harvest. So that's a big concern. We actually use probably at least a year old manure that's been semi-composted. True compost is the best, that you actually turn it regularly, let the pile heat up, turn it, it'll heat up again. That will help break it down. That's the best method. If it's raw manure, you need to be very careful because there could be a possibility of introducing contaminants.
What about the microbes, disturbing the microbes through tilling?
Well, you're actually adding microbes when you add the manure. So it's a beneficial thing. Just be aware to put it on early enough.
Now, right now?
You could put it on now. We usually do it in March when the soil warms up, and then we don't plant till June.
All right. And if you put it on now, would you need to till it into the soil now?
It's always best to till it in because then immediately you'll get the microbes interacting.
But then you have erosion problems
exactly.
If you till it in right now.
Right.
Okay. You're recommending March.
I am. I'm sticking with March.
All right, Patty. Thank you so much for your question. And Kathleen, you probably get this question quite a lot. Is there a do you have manure preferences? Is there a better kind of manure?
You know, my husband and I have a joke that if we don't start talking about manure within 40 minutes of sitting down, then we're not having a farming conversation. So, yes, of course I have my favorite. My favorite is cattle manure.
And why is that?
I've just seen over the years, it seems to have the best combination of nutrients and less odor and breaks down perfectly well. And I actually learned the system from Ron Roseman out in Harlan. He has a beef cattle herd out there, and he makes his own compost. So he mixes the manure in windrows, they call it, long piles with spent hay or straw, carbon-based material, and he actually turns it. So it comes out to be a really nice compost.
Nice. Well, it's so funny. How many, and Richard, you can testify to this. So many times when we talk about compost on this show, we say, and do you have a compost pile that gets to that temperature and do you turn it regularly? And it seems like most of us, including me, have the answer, no.
Correct.
not really.
Not really.
So it's difficult to monitor it. But if you tell the certification agency you are using compost, you have to show your record, your log of when you turn it and the temperature heating up. So everybody I know, including myself, goes under the raw manure rule and puts it on 4 months ahead of harvest.
All right. You can join our conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. They don't have to be questions about manure. 866-780-9100. Or you can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Christina is on the line next from Panora. Hello, Christina.
Hello.
Hi. What's your question?
I have an organic farmer friend. He has soil crops, but he has also started doing hydroponic farming. And he was telling me that because the hydroponic farming does not have anything to do with soil or soil conservation, that he cannot get them organic certified, and that this poses a bit of a problem when he is trying to sell them at the farmers markets, then people are wondering, well, why are they not organic certified? And so I was wondering if you could talk to that issue of exactly why the definition of organic certified is what it is, and if that is going to possibly be changing.
Right. That's a good question. And yeah, hydroponics, aquaponics, it's an issue they've been grappling with for years at the National Organic Program, or actually the National Organic Standards Board, who makes the rules for organic and passes them on to the National Organic Program. And you're correct. They still have not come out with definitive rules for hydroponics. It's a difficult thing to regulate since it's not in the soil. However, I'm surprised and somewhat happy to hear that people are actually asking for certificates at farmers markets, because I haven't seen that. I mean, most people, like I said, if they know the grower and they can visit the farm and see the practices they're using, that's usually good enough for most Iowans I've found. So if that is an issue, perhaps the farmer could talk to us about it, and we could talk about it at the IDOL certification board and see if there's something we could do to help him.
Well, and Christina, I think a while back I was talking to Alan Patillo on the show, and we were talking about aquaponics, where he was using the water from fish farming to grow vegetables as well. And I believe that he said there was a possibility for organic certification in that system because you don't have to add nutrients to the water. Maybe I'm misremembering.
I'm glad he's optimistic because there's nothing officially on the books yet.
All right.
But people are working on it, and we invite input. Rules can be changed.
All right. Next up, let's go to Chuck on the line in Sully. Hi, Chuck.
Hi.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
My wife and I planted a couple of little red maple trees this spring, and they're doing fine, but apparently a deer has come and rubbed the bark off of one of them.
Yeah.
What do I do to save this little tree?
Well, hopefully most of the bark is still there. If they have rubbed off the majority of the bark, that tree may not survive long term. What you might want to do is maybe pound in three very sturdy wooden stakes around the trunk of the tree, about a foot apart in a triangle. And that should prevent any additional rubbing of the bucks as far as their antlers on the tree. That's basically what they do in the fall of the year.
They have to rub the velvet off.
Yes, they have to rub the velvet off. And so that's what they're doing. And if you have three sturdy stakes around the trunk, they can't reach in there and do that as far as damaging the tree. So I would do that to make sure no additional damage occurs. Painting it, wrapping it doesn't really do any good once the damage has occurred. So you really can't do much to help the tree, but make sure that no additional damage occurs yet this fall.
But as long as the tree's not girdled, right? As long as the bark isn't rubbed off all the way around?
Right. It still has a chance of surviving. It kind of really depends upon how much bark has been removed. If you go out there and let's say more than half of the bark has been removed, it's been rubbed off, the prospect for that tree is not very good. How much bark has been removed, you might get some type of wood decay fungus invade that area, and so you may get a wood rot at some point. If the damage is more limited, let's say maybe 25% or so, the prospects are better. So it kind of really depends upon the amount of damage.
All right, Chuck, thanks a lot for your call and good luck with that. And, you know, Richard, this morning I went out for my morning walk and leaves were falling fast and furious because of the heavy frost last night. Does this mean we're going to lose our peak?
Well, it just means that certain tree species like the green ash, they tend to do that right after a hard frost or freeze. They tend to do that. Some other trees like the oaks, no. So they should still get a good color as far as the red oaks and maybe some of the swamp white oaks. But some trees, when you have that first frost or freeze, like the green ash, the ginkgo, some other trees, they just drop everything within maybe 2 or 3 days.
Oh, my kids did have a good time chasing leaves and trying to catch them this morning. So there's an upside there. Anne is on the line. And Malcolm, hi, Anne.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
It's for Kathleen. On the organic certification process, is there an upper or lower limit to certifying?
Yes, there is.
Vegetables?
Yes, there is, Anne. If you sell less than 5,000 a year, you don't have to be certified, but we highly recommend that you register your farm as organic with Maury Wills and the IDOLS organic certification program.
And you say less than 5,000, are you saying less than $5,000 of income or what?
Yes.
Okay. All right, go on. Sorry.
Yeah, that's a good clarification. So that way you can tell people you're registered as organic with the state as opposed to being certified.
But you're still not certified, right?
Right.
Okay. And is there an upper limit?
No, there's no upper limit.
All right, thank you.
All right, Ann, thanks a lot for your call. And you can get in on the conversation at 866-75-780. My goodness, I lost my phone number. 866-780-9100. 866-780-9100. Or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. John is on the line from Clarion. Hi, John.
Good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
My question is, we're around Clarion, we have several large chicken barns, and I wanted to know if the manure out of those can be used in an organic operation, and what are the restrictions?
Yes, that's very definitely available to use. As a matter of fact, we get our manure from conventional operations because the rule in the United States, unlike Europe, is you can use conventional operation manure. However, you do have to follow those manure rules that I was talking about earlier. And so for horticultural crops, raw manure has to be put on 4 months ahead of harvest. And for agronomic crops, corn and beans, has to be put on 3 months ahead of harvest. But as I mentioned earlier, we usually put ours on in March. So that way, there's no issue of contamination. And by the time you harvest in October, actually, we still haven't harvested our corn yet. So hopefully it'll be harvested before November. There's plenty of time for it to break down.
All right, John, thanks so much for your call. And if those rules changed, there'd be a manure crisis, wouldn't there?
There would be.
Okay. Well, hopefully we won't have to talk about that. Jack is on the line from Davenport next. Hi, Jack.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
My question is about home composting. In the past, I've used those plastic containers that, you know, you load up with your home composting material.
Mm-hmm.
And that they have to be, you know, taken care of. They have to get turned. They have to get watched, you know, for all the concerns about composting.
True.
And I've read about these new felt, you know, these cloth grow bags. The manufacturer claims that you just load them up because they aerate. They don't have to get turned. Hmm. I was wondering if your guest has any experience with these. Newer technology.
Yeah, I've had no experience with those.
Have you read about them?
I guess I would have maybe some serious doubts about how effective they might be, but I don't have any experience with them at this time, no.
For commercial compost producers actually cover their compost with these felt cloths, so it might be the same material. I haven't seen them, but what's that?
Oh, I think he's having some interference. Go on.
Okay. So, that'd be something we could test at Iowa State. So I'll look into it and see if those bags are out there. Probably like Richard, I'm thinking it's hard to substitute turning. You know, if it's just, I mean, you can compost anaerobically. It just takes longer. So the more you turn, the more oxygen you're getting in there, the faster it'll break down.
Well, and just like that robotic weeding, again, this sounds really, really good to those of us who are labor averse.
Exactly.
Jack, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, Alex is on the line in Davenport. Hi, Alex.
Hi.
Hi.
I actually have a two-part question that's kind of unrelated, but one is I have a small garden, and I wanted to know what kind of is the best thing to cover. We don't grow anything in the winter to cover it up for the winter and keep it healthy for the next spring. And then in the spring, we were thinking of trying to grow a butterfly garden, and I was wondering if they had any recommendations for what kind of plants and flowers are best.
Well, we actually have a publication on butterfly gardening, and so if you go on the Internet to the Iowa State University homepage and type in, there's a search box. If you type in butterfly gardening, that should bring you to that site where they list various plants that you can put in the garden.
Okay, great.
And then covering your crops, we just use straw. Richard, how about you?
That would be fine. If you're thinking about a cover crop, maybe cereal rye or something of that.
Oh, but you're talking about cover for protection from
the cold? Exactly, yeah.
Okay, as far as protecting something?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Just to cover it for the winter, yeah.
Well, you could actually cover it with leaves and maybe till those in the spring if you wish. You could do that.
That's what I've done in the past. Mm-hmm. I just didn't know if that was they didn't seem to break down much in the winter, and I just wondered.
Well, they don't. They don't. But I would probably, if you could, either shred those or chop them up so they don't blow away, and you can just leave them there on the surface during the wintertime and then till them in the spring.
All right. So if you run the lawnmower over them and then –
just throw them on the yard.
All right.
The garden.
Sounds like a plan. Here's an email question. This is from Laura. We have a large hydrangea tree loaded with heavy blossoms. Last year during the December blizzard, several branches broke due to the weight of the flowers. When would be the best time to prune this year's flowers so we don't lose any more branches?
I'd probably do it probably around mid-November or so. If we do have a early snow, it tends to be rather wet. And that weight can maybe break them off, so maybe around mid-November or so.
All right. And then Christine would like to know if you have any recommendations for planting garlic. And is there still time?
It's getting kind of late, but I would still go ahead and do it if you haven't done so. Do it as soon as you can, plant them, and then maybe around mid-November, cover them with several inches of straw.
Okay, and she also wants to know, on the subject of tomatoes, I heard something about putting cornmeal on the ground where tomatoes had grown in order to combat the blight that overwinters. What do you think?
No, that's not going to work, unfortunately. The best thing they can do is basically in the fall of the year, if they suspect they had a disease problem that year, make sure that they pull those plants and very carefully clean up all that debris, remove it from the garden, and then destroy it.
All right.
And then next year, look for a site where you haven't grown tomatoes for at least 2 or 3 years.
All right. There's so much wishful thinking involved in gardening advice, isn't there?
But that corn gluten meal is used for weed.
Weed control.
Cool.
Right.
So that's right. Maybe they're confusing
the source
that.
Of the, right?
Yeah.
And we all want a magic bullet. All right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back to answer more of your questions in a moment. And we do have a few lines open for you right now at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Geron and Iowa State University Extension organic specialist Kathleen Dellett. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me, Iowa State University Extension Organic Specialist Kathleen Dellett and Iowa State University Extension Horticulturist Richard Geron. And you are welcome to join the conversation. If you have questions about organic gardening or farming, give us a call. If you have questions about your lawn, your landscape, your garden, generally, give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And next up is Tom in Arcadia. Hi, Tom.
Good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
Yeah, I have about 65, maybe 70% ash on my farm place here. And I'm looking for that borer ash.
The emerald ash borer, right?
Yeah, the emerald ash, yeah. And I want to start a nursery. And I just wanted your advice on if I should do that if I can't spend too much money on buying bigger trees, I'd like to start them.
Okay, you want to start some trees?
Yes.
Okay.
And I'd like some advice on what varieties to plant and...
All right. And
so forth.
Arcadia is in Carroll County, so
right.
You're pretty far away from where the emerald ash borer is in
right.
Iowa right now. But, of course, we don't know how fast it will travel. But you're looking to diversify and you want to grow
small. Yeah, I want replacements. I want to grow some replacements for it.
Okay. Well, one option would be to maybe buy some small seedling trees from a nursery. They might be a foot, maybe 2 feet tall. And then you could plant those, and as they got bigger, then you could transplant them to their permanent site. Another option would be to go out and collect seeds, for example, acorns, and go ahead and plant those this fall, and they should come up next spring. So you could do things like acorns for the oaks. You could do walnuts. You could do buckeyes, where you actually go out and collect the seeds and then plant the seeds this fall. And then you'll basically have some seedlings next spring.
Oh, good. Yeah, that's just the answer I was looking for, and appreciate the program you guys got.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for your call, Tom, and good luck with that.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Next up, let's go to Melody in Bloomfield and return to the subject of manure. Hi, Melody.
Hi. Hey, I was wondering, I've heard pros and cons. Can you use dog waste for compost?
I definitely would not. Things like cat manure or dog manure, no. We typically suggest not. There are certain organisms that might be in the pet manure that you typically don't want to put in the garden. So,
like worm eggs and...
Things like that, yeah. There are certain things that you wouldn't want. So we typically say, as far as the compost pile, do not put in cat or dog feces.
All right, and I see complete agreement from Kathleen over here
good.
As well.
That's good to know. Thank you.
All right, Melody,
bye-bye.
Thanks a lot for your call. Next up, let's go to Francis in Ames. Hi, Francis.
Hi. I have a question about oaks. I planted an oak about, 6 years ago, a very young tree. And each fall and winter, it holds its leaves.
Mm-hmm.
And it drives me crazy because I think, oh, just my luck. I got a one-off stinker. So what is it? It's supposed to be a red oak.
Right.
And I want to know, is it ever going to lose its leaves? Because I don't want that kind of shade in the winter.
Well,
I planted it on the south side of the house, hoping that it would shelter the house from the late sun, the sun, and it's doing its job in the summer, but it's worthless to me in the winter.
Right. Well, the oak trees do drop their leaves late. That's just their way of doing things.
It doesn't take the leaves off until like March.
Right. Well, that's just kind of the way that oaks are. They just drop very, very late. Now, the weather conditions will influence when they drop. I will also say that their age is also a factor, that a younger tree tends to retain its leaves longer than a larger, mature tree. So as the tree gets larger, it may begin to shed a little bit earlier. Instead of March, it might be, let's say, for example, December. But there's not much you can do, but as the tree does get bigger, it may shed a little bit earlier as it does get bigger.
All right, Francis, I know that's not what you wanted to hear. Thanks a lot for your call. Next up, let's go to Nick in Iowa City. Hi, Nick.
Hi there.
Hi.
My question is, I watched a program a long time ago, let's just call it Bull Spit, and one thing that they tackled was organically grown stuff, and what the information that they put out was that the pesticides that are used in commercial organic farming operations are actually an older variety of pesticides. They still use pesticides, they're just organic pesticides, and they're actually possibly more harmful. I was just looking for some feedback on that.
Kathleen?
Right. Well, I have seen that too, and I just want to start out by saying Iowa has the lowest amount of pesticide used on organic farms here of any place I've worked, and I've worked all over the country. I don't know if it's our inherent cheapness here or good sense or both, but when I talk to organic farmers here, they say the first order of business is if you see a problem, walk away and see if the beneficial insects, the natural competitors will take care of it. So pesticide use here is very, very low on organic farms. But in answer to your question specifically, yes, there are products that can be used in organic. However, a lot of them are regulated, like copper. You can use copper, which is an old-fashioned pesticide for a fungicide against diseases. Excuse me. And if you use it, you're going to be watched. You're going to be regulated. It's a restricted pesticide. So, yes, maybe there are people out there in California that are using pesticides, old-fashioned pesticides, but I haven't seen that be a problem here in Iowa.
All right, Nick, thanks a lot for your question. And you can join the conversation at 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100, or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Christopher is on the line next in Dakota City. Hi, Christopher.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
I got a question. We moved into a new place this summer. And we're wanting to plant a vegetable garden next spring. We got a spot picked out, and we just want to know what the best way to prepare it for next spring would be.
Okay. I would destroy the existing vegetation. If you have grass there or something else, basically destroy it. Then once you've done that, then I would till the soil, work it up. And as you till the soil, if you feel there's quite a bit of clay in the soil, it's very difficult to work or till, then I would try to find some organic matter, and that could be compost or well-rotted manure, and I would work that into the soil.
Do this before winter or wait until spring to do this?
Well, you could do it. You could actually start this fall. If it's a fairly flat area where you're not going to have any erosion, you could do that this fall.
Okay.
And then you can have the site ready for planting next spring. But you could also do it next spring. So, but that would be the main thing, basically destroy the existing vegetation, go ahead and till it, and then if you find that it's not very good soil, try to find some organic matter, compost, well-rotted manure, maybe put on 2 or 3 inches of that, and then till that into the soil.
Okay.
All right, Christopher. Thanks a lot for your call. Next up, let's go to Lee in Panora, and this goes back to a question we were talking about earlier. You are the person with the aquaponics program that we were talking about earlier, Lee?
No.
Okay.
I get very familiar with it. I work there part-time. What's interesting is the beds where the fish manure is filtered through. If you look in the bottom of those beds, even though there's never been a night crawler in there, after about 6 months, there's about 2 inches of new dirt and worms. So even though it is not a soil-based system, according to NOPA, and cannot be certified, it is a soil-building program.
That's interesting.
I just thought that was interesting, and I know Kathleen, and she knows me pretty well. I have an organic farm in Panora.
Right. Well, thanks for the info. And like I said, it's your national organic program, and your voices will be listened to. So keep that information coming to the NOSB, Organic Standards Board, and let them know that it can be certifiable.
All right, Lee. Thanks a lot for your call. And next up, let's go to Sue in Coralville. Hello, Sue.
Yeah, hi.
Hi. What's your question?
Well, my question is I had bought some brown liquid, some kind of concoction from the Extension Service. It's supposed to, you put it in your soil in the springtime, and it's supposed to enhance the soil and keep working, some kind of microorganism, I believe. And I want to know if that's still available to buy somewhere, because it really did make a difference naturally with my flower beds.
Interesting. Which county is that?
Johnson County.
Huh. I'm going there this afternoon. I'll have to ask them. I haven't heard about that. Have you?
I haven't heard of any products sold by the Extension Service. Possibly a master gardener, but in general, the Extension Service does not sell plant material or products for the most part. So, I'm not sure.
Sounds like you've got a mystery.
And you could just call the Extension office and ask them about it. It probably is a master gardener project, like Richard was saying, and there are. A lot of liquid, they just call them liquid fertilizers out there that have microbial content in them. So it could be something like that.
How long ago was this, Sue?
This was probably 2 years ago. And, you know, I bought a gallon of it, and you just used a little bit of it, mix it with your gallon of water, and then water your flower beds with it. And it, I mean, my plants were amazing. And I ran out of it. I didn't save the container because I recycle, and now I wish I could find some more.
Probably if you go to any shop that sells organic products, you could find something very similar. There are a lot of products like that on the market.
All right, Sue, thanks a lot for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. We've got time for probably a couple more calls this hour. Susan is on the line in Fairfield. Hi, Susan.
Hi. I have a question about a large planting of native shrubs. We have it in front of a very public building on campus here in Fairfield. And we are doing everything organically. We have a lot of dandelions, you know, that reseeded, you know, from grass nearby and all that. And, you know, other kinds of weeds, you know, coming up in this planting. Originally, we had put down cardboard, well, first composted manure, and then cardboard, and then bark mulch on top, you know, when the plants were just like, you know, like little pencils. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these shrubs have taken off, you know, and gotten much bigger. But we still have, you know, quite a bit of space between them, and we've got this big weed control problem. So I'm wondering what you might recommend.
Well, it sounds like you've been doing everything that I would recommend, having that sheeting and using bark mulch. And it's inevitable you will be doing hand weeding if you're not using herbicides.
Mm-hmm.
I would just go out maybe after a good rain, maybe with a trowel or some other digging device, and basically dig up what I can. And then if you have them destroyed, then obviously put back the mulch, and that should deter additional weed seeds from germinating.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Susan. And let's go to Matt in Guthrie Center. Hi, Matt.
Hi. See, I've got a volunteer oak tree growing in the garden. Okay. I spotted it this spring. It's only, you know, 5-6 inches tall. Okay. When's the best time to transplant that?
I would do that early next spring, typically early to mid-April. In the meantime, I might put some chicken wire fencing or hardware cloth around it this fall so the rabbits don't get it, because right. they might just chew it right off. And then early next spring, as soon as the ground is workable, dig it up and move it. Should
okay,
be fine.
Thanks for the help.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Matt. And let's squeeze in a couple email questions here. This is from Brian in Altoona. I used a weed and feed type dry spread on my lawn this fall, and I may have to follow up with spot treatment herbicide for more weeds. Can I still collect the fallen leaves off my lawn this weekend for garden compost, or will that kill my plants?
That should be okay. If you're going to do that and you compost it, during the composting process, any herbicide residue on the leaves should break down, so that shouldn't be a problem.
All right, this one's from Susan. I have a hedge of pyramidal arborvitae planted, mm-hmm. and I noticed that on the inside of the trees, the green has turned to brown, mm-hmm. but the outside of the tree is green.
Right.
Is that normal?
That is actually normal. In the fall of the year, most of your trees, like your maples and your oaks, they shed all their foliage. The evergreens lose a portion, but only a portion, maybe 25%, maybe a third. And they lose their oldest foliage, which is toward the middle. So that's why it's turning brown at this time of year.
All right. And Randy's on the line in Coralville. Hi, Randy.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
So I'm buying 4 large trees from a local nursery, and they range from 4 to 8 inches in trunk diameter. Okay. And they want to transplant them right now. They use a tree spade, take them out of the ground, transplant them right to my yard. Okay. Is that safe? Is that okay right now?
Actually, fall is a possibility. What kind of trees are they?
They are red maple, white oak, and a honey locust.
Okay. No, you can do that in the fall when the trees are basically going dormant. The main thing on that, if they do that, as soon as they're done planting, water the ground, soak it thoroughly, and then water those trees periodically until the ground freezes in early December or so.
Okay, and I don't have to add anything to the soil
or
any type of protection. Okay.
And try to
plant them
at the same depth they're currently growing right now. And then next spring and summer, if we have a dry year, also water those trees next year too.
All right, Randy, thanks for your call. And the final question today from Nick in Chicago. The locust tree outside our apartment has deposited a truckload of seed pods. The other locusts down the block have no seed pods. Why is that?
Just the magic of nature. there are trees. Typically, if you have the native tree, they definitely produce pods, but they have selected cultivars that do not produce the pods. And that's the ones they typically grow in the nursery. But apparently one got by the nursery.
and there's a little more cleanup work to
yes.
do. All right. Richard Giron, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron. Kathleen Dellett, thank you.
Thank you, Charity.
Always a pleasure to have you on the show. ISU Extension organic specialist Kathleen Dellett. And the 13th Annual Iowa Organic Conference is coming up on November 17th and 18th. You can find out more information on our Facebook page. It's in Iowa City this year. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Technical support today from Jason Burns. I'm Charity Nebbe. On Monday, the poetry of Mike Pace. Talk of Iowa is a production of IPR News.